Blog Talk Radio.
This is BC Radio Live with Philip and Eric, live online at blogtalkradio.com/BC Radio. Aloha! This is Wednesday night, February 27th, 2008, and this is BC Radio Live. Tonight, our guest, Black 47, is an Irish-American rock band based in New York. They are very political and thoroughly Irish, and their latest album is called Iraq. It is due out next Tuesday, March 4th, and tonight we will speak with lead singer, band leader, guitarist Larry Kerwin. We are having technical issues with the chat room tonight, so there will be no live video feed for this segment. I am Philip Wynn, Chief Geek at BC Magazine, and I am joined tonight by Eric Olson, founder and publisher of BC Magazine. Hi, Eric.
Philip, hello.
Good to hear from you. And also with us tonight is Lisa McKay, executive editor of BC Magazine. Welcome to the show, Lisa.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Well, so we're saying we have no chat room?
I can't seem to get into the chat room. That's correct.
Well.
This is very unfortunate.
Good golly, Miss Molly. Well, I'm sure you'll keep trying. We seem to, last week, what happened last week? We couldn't get into the phones at all for like 20 minutes or something?
Last year the switchboard locked up on me for the first, I went back and listened. It was only the first 6 minutes of the show. It felt like roughly an hour.
Yeah, you did a pretty good job covering, I must say. You ran through the roster of all our shows and started explaining everything that surrounded you in the room.
No.
No, it was good. You did a good job.
Well, hopefully we'll be able to get some audio samples from Black 47 a little later in the show. Right now there seems to be a delay with that as well.
Well, maybe Larry can perform them for us over the phone.
That's right. Kind of an audio, live audio a cappella performance, perhaps. Well,
maybe so.
A
lot of pressure, I must say, but...
Let's go ahead and talk to Larry. The band is Black 47. Their new album is called Iraq. Iraq is the band's first release on the United for Opportunity label and will be released next week, Tuesday, March 4th. Black 47 are touring in support of the album. You can find out if they're playing near you at either their website, black47.com, or the label website, ufomusic.com. Tonight we are very privileged to be able to spend close to an hour with Larry Kerwin, leader of Black 47. Welcome to BC Radio Live, Larry.
How you doing?
Philip. We are exceptionally well. How are you?
I'm okay. You're in New York City.
So now, you're clearly Irish, but I know you're New York-based. Are you from Ireland, personally?
Yeah, I'm from Ireland originally, a small town called Wexford on the southeast corner of Ireland. And I immigrated here in the mid-70s, and I've lived in New York pretty much ever since.
You're practically a native.
Yeah, probably more so than most at this point.
Well, I hear the mid-Atlantic aspect to the accent, because of course I can hear the Irish, but it's not nearly as severe as some. So, I mean, it's definitely leavened with some U.S. there. So it is a classic mid-Atlantic accent.
Yeah, I didn't try to keep the Irish. It's not that I try to get rid of it either. I just have a sharp ear, so I listen to accents. I'm a playwright also, so maybe that's part of the reason, you know, you pick up something. I hear it sometimes, especially when I go back to Ireland, I hear the broad A's. Yeah, but everybody in Ireland speaks different. They speak quicker. That's why Irish people tend to think of Americans as more stupid.
Because of the rapidity of their speech?
Due to the rapidity, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
It's not just who we elect president?
Oh, well, they got that one down pretty well. But no, just in general, I always find it kind of strange because I slow down my accent when I came over here, slow down my method of speech because you get tired eventually, people saying, what? You know, because people speak a little slower, but from being here, I realize that doesn't mean people are stupider because they speak slower, but Irish people tend to think that.
Well, sure. Anyone who's faster at anything than anyone tends to feel superior to those
right.
lower, whether it be speech or foot speed or typing speed or probably, you know, pretty much anything. What brought you here in the mid-70s? What was the draw?
Oh, adventure. You know, just to see a different world. It was in Ireland, everyone's Irish at that point anyways. It's changed very much in the last 10, 15 years, but at that point, everybody there was very homogenous. And it was just a great thrill to land in the middle of New York City and, you know, be thrown into the midst of this multicultural society in a way that we would never, never even imagine it in Ireland. I mean, you see the movies and everything, but, you know, movies and media are all planned to look a certain way, but you get into New York, at that point, well,
we know there's very little planned in New York.
Yeah, well, at that point, nothing was planned. It was pretty much out of control. But say, for instance, Times Square wouldn't be the place to look at multiculturalism anymore. Canal Street would be down on the, you know, because it's not touristy.
Right, right. Times Square has certainly been cleaned up, hasn't it?
Yeah, totally. It looks different. It looks very different to me now.
It is. It's been Disneyfied.
Well, not even that. The lights are all different. You know, it's much more brightly lit now.
Sure.
Because in the winter times, we play in a place called Connolly's on 45th Street. We do a winter Saturday night residency there. And I often come out, you know, at 3 in the morning and look down Times Square, and you'll see, you know, tourists walking by with their Bloomingdale shopping bags and whatever. And back in the day, you wouldn't have dreamed of identifying yourself as actually having something of value on you.
Right.
You're going to be ripped off. Yeah.
I remember wandering Times Square as an 18-year-old, so that would be 76, I guess.
Uh-huh.
And it was a pretty scary place.
Yeah, it was a very tough place.
You had to, you know, be on your guard, and you were going to be panhandled, and you were going to be kind of buffeted about. But
yeah,
it was exciting too.
If they could tell that you weren't used to it.
Right.
But you know, you grew up quickly there because you only got ripped off once and then you realize, well, that's it, yeah.
Right. And then you toughen up and become a lot more wary and all
exactly,
of that.
Yeah.
Were you a musician already when you came? Is that what you came here to do?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. I had a guitar and yeah, I got gigs in bars. When you get really hungry, you can go into a bar and say, "You have to hire me." Yeah.
With a hungry, lean look.
Yeah, well, maybe not even the look, but the actual hunger.
The reality is.
The reality of hunger is I'm playing. You know, maybe you're not going to pay me, but maybe you will too.
Well, there's always tips, I suppose.
Tips and this food, yeah.
Were you playing, you know, quote-unquote traditional Irish stuff? Were you already doing originals? Were you doing kind of more rocking stuff like you've, you know, evolved toward? Or was that a folkier kind of feel back then?
No, Ireland was very mixed musically. You know, you could get everything from rockabilly to classical there. And then it was leaven by traditional music because there was a folk boom going on back in Ireland. So you knew a lot of songs that would be known out here too. But then, you know, a Buddy Holly song is a Buddy Holly song in Dublin and it's one in New York. You know, it's a common standard, or an Eddie Cochran one, or the Beatles, or whatever, you know.
So you were playing rock and roll?
I was playing rock and roll, and I was playing traditional, you know, but more, you know, traditional that would help you stay alive in a tough bar.
Speaking of Buddy Holly, I hear that you own a Buddy Holly guitar.
You know, that's funny because the last interview I did up at Sirius, they said I owned a Jimi Hendrix one. Is this
on your website?
PR?
It's on your website, dude.
Oh, I that's a big joke.
It's in the Q&A section.
All right. Yeah. I was wondering how they got that, yeah.
Well, they were researching, weren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was, you know, reading through the site and boning up and said, but yeah, I said you had a Buddy Holly Fender and a something Hendrix played once or something or touched or looked in the direction of or spat at or something.
That's
there was
right.
a Hendrix connection there.
It's all lies, though.
Oh, okay.
Right, well, the very next sentence does say that he also owns a bridge in Brooklyn that he's considering putting on the market.
Ah, well, right. So there you go.
But my guitar was so battered up. I have a guitar, a Sunburst, a Fender Strat, the same one, the same type that Buddy Holly and Bob Dylan and Hendrix used. So people would always come up to me and say, you know, that's got to be a 65 because it has so much wear and tear on it. And I would think, nah, it's actually a 92. You know,
you were just beating the hell out of it.
Yeah, and then finally I began to think, yeah, the hell with them, you know. Sure, Buddy Holly owned it. And they're happy.
All right. Well, I should have picked up on the, obviously, on the Brooklyn Bridge angle. That
well, it's still going. Would you send me a grand and I'll send you the deeds to it?
Okay. Well, that's a deal,
it's
man.
Pretty good. I just charge five.
That's like that's worthy of eBay. I mean, that's really that's something of a deal.
And get you a good price on a Williamsburg too.
Hey, when you mentioned the multiculturalism, you know how that much that's changed in Ireland. It made me think of the Academy Awards. And here was this Irish couple, and the woman has this, you know, rather extravagantly Eastern European name. And then when she spoke, she had a really interesting combination of Irish.
Of Czech and Dublin, yeah.
Yeah.
I do a show on, I do a number of shows on Sirius Satellite Radio.
I saw that. We just started getting it. I'm going to listen to them.
I actually interviewed them, and I was struck by the same thing because, yeah, I could hear the Dublin, and yet I'd been to Czechoslovakia and could hear the Czech. It's a pretty fascinating accent.
So what do you think about that? How do you like the movie and the album, or just their music in general?
It's wonderful. Yeah. Glenn Hansard is an old friend of mine, and he's got to be one of the nicest people in show business. Very earnest, very honest, beautiful kind of person, so it couldn't have happened to a nicer guy. Yeah.
Their performance was really powerful. I mean, it really was beautiful, and their voices blended so well. I mean, I really did get tingles watching it, you know, and I'm fairly jaded, I suppose.
They're real. Yeah.
And, yeah, I mean, it was really very beautiful, and I mean, you could really tell, and Jon Stewart, the host, made a big deal about it. I mean, you know, he was clearly moved.
Yeah.
And, it was really neat.
Real is an unusual term nowadays.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really felt real. You're right. It was very here and now and genuine. There's nothing contrived about it. And it's a beautiful song.
Yeah, it is.
Well, let's talk about, speaking of beautiful songs, you guys have done 10. And is this the 10th? Is Rack the 10th or 11th?
You know, I don't know. I someday I'm going to have to go back and sit down and count them.
Well, it's on the site.
Either 10th or 11th. I don't think it's 12th. So.
They're listed,
you know,
on the site.
Let's see if I can come up with a way to play a little bit of a song here. We're still running into some technical issues, but I'm going to see if I can come up with a very lo-fi way of giving us a sample of the Ballad of Cindy Sheehan.
Well,
didn't come out here.
It doesn't seem to be working. But Philip, being the tech whiz that he is, I mean, we know he'll stay on it like a bulldog. He'll be on it tenaciously.
Yeah.
I just listened about 3 times in a row to Iraq today, and speaking of real and powerful, it really is. It's quite a statement. It really holds up together. It's very unified. And it's really very powerful. I really could feel your empathy with these people. You know, I mean, they felt like real people, the stories you were telling. And I guess in many cases they are real people, right?
Well, they are. They're extensions of real people, I would say.
Okay.
The way looking at it, it's a mixture of fact and fiction. You know, I often compare, well, I don't compare the album in any sense, but I was using as a template for the album the Ernest Hemingway book, For Whom the Bell Tolls, so that if you really wanted to learn about the Spanish Civil War, it's kind of hopeless to go into textbooks because you don't really get the feel of it. But if you pick up his novel, For Whom the Bell Tolls, you're immediately amidst all the color and the atmosphere of the Spanish Civil War, and that clues you into a textbook then. So that was the idea behind Iraq, was to really get people to get away from the 30-second sound bites and to get a feel of what it's like to be a young person, a young American person, thrown into the cauldron that is Iraq. So it's almost like a dipping, as it were, is the way I look at it.
Yeah, and I think you, I mean, clearly you have a certain perspective, you know, an opinion overall that comes through, but I think you also do a real good job of reflecting various perspectives, you know, within the characters. I mean, not everything is just, you know, absolutely broadly anti-war. I mean, you know, you're seeing things from the inside, and it looks like you did an awful lot of research. It's really a powerful work. I think people are going to respond well to it. I assume you've been playing it live?
Yeah, we were against the war, Black 47, from before the war even, because we knew it was coming and knew it was going to be a disaster. You didn't have to be a brain surgeon or a rocket scientist to tell that you can't go into a country halfway around the world that is already riven with, you know, sectarian divide, a religious divide that goes back 1,400 years, and expect to come out of it with the Western-style democracy that you were hoping to do. So to us, this was a no-no from the start. So pretty soon after the war, I wrote the first song, Downtown Baghdad Blues, and that came out on an album previously, a different version of it. That and one song towards the end called Southside Chicago Waltz. And they became popular through Black 47 fans taking them to Iraq when they were serving or exchanging MP3s. So they were actually popular over there. So through that, I met more people who, through emails basically, who were writing to me and reflecting what was going on there. Now, many of them are actually not into being there, but believe this was a just war. But at the same time, you could get the flavor of the place through them. So, to be fair, I wanted to reflect some of their feelings rather than mine.
You know? I think you do that really well. And I think that makes it a much more powerful statement, you know, even more so, because you do show there's a lot of nuances. There's a lot of points of view. And, you know, whether or not a given soldier wants to be there, of course, they are there, and being there, clearly they want to come out ahead and survive and achieve their goals. And I think you reflect that well, too, and that shows some real artistic honesty, I think.
Well, it's also really interesting, you know, to work on the points of view that are not actually your own, because one of the problems of this country right now is that, you know, people have opinions, strong opinions oftentimes, and they can't get into a dialogue with people who have opposite opinions. Whereas growing up in Ireland, where there was a real political divide, where people had actually been killed in a civil war in the 1920s, and the political parties of the time I was growing up in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, they were still split on those political lines. And then you add to that that you have actually real socialists and communists in Ireland and farmers' parties and all types of parties there. And you could be living in a street with 10 people with very different, 10 different houses with almost, you know, opposite points of view. But you had to get on. You had to be able to. It was a communal society. So people lived together and worked together and had very different political views, but you had to get along. I mean, Republicans and Democrats are, to an outsider, and I'm not really an outsider anymore, are so, center to right wing that to someone from outside, there's not really a lot of difference except in just sheer shouting at each other. So it was important for me to be able to show the different points of view, to show a real pro-war point of view, like the Battle of Fallujah. That song is basically a war anthem.
Yeah, I'm looking at that right now, and that's exactly what I was thinking about.
Yeah, and that's why I wrote it, was almost like a Greek epic,
Right.
To reflect what the Greeks were writing about, the glory of battle. Yeah. And it was a thrill to write it. It's a thrill to sing it, even though I don't agree with it. It's,
right.
Wow. You're really up there kicking ass,
It's your artistic...
You're dodging hell in the dirt,
Right. Well, it's kind of like it's living vicariously.
Yeah.
And it shows real empathy.
And we have a lot of supporters, a lot of fans who are in the service, and they come to the gigs and they're thrilled, because it's about them. For once, it's not just your dumb yellow ribbon on the back of a car that's just stuck there. You buy it for $250, making some guy in Georgia or somewhere rich. Yeah.
Right.
They're actually hearing their story. And that to me was a lot more important than writing Larry Kerwin's, slightly left-wing opinions. It doesn't appeal to me as being particularly dramatic, but you get some kid who's been gone over there at the age of 19, 20, 21, and has no idea where he's going. All of a sudden, he's thrust into the middle of Anbar province with everyone hating him. And he's wondering, well, what the hell am I doing here?
Would it be too much for you? I mean, it would be difficult, or just would you not like to recite a line or two, a verse or two from Battle of Fallujah?
I'm not sure. I just had a couple of drinks.
Let me tell you the story.
The first words.
Let me tell you the story of a place without glory.
Let me tell you a story of a place without glory in a sand pit they call Iraq, where Abu Zarqawi and his homie jihadis decided to set up shop. The Hajis and Qaeda were holed up inside the mosques and the booby-trap shacks, but the U.S. Marines put a dent in their dreams. Sent them halfway to hell and the back. Here's to the old men back in the States. Don't ever let on that they used you. When you're down in the dirt with your heart in your mouth, dodging hell at the Battle of Fallujah. Here's to the patriots lined up on TV, falling over themselves to support you. When you're knocking down doors for them DC whores, kicking ass at the Battle of Fallujah.
Wow, that's powerful stuff. That's good poetry.
I never said it before.
I like it. It gives me I feel like you said it's the difference between just describing and news and 30-second news bites and art being there, literature.
Well, what TV doesn't get? Because they're so used to faking it and letting people think that violence is actually, a plausible thing. I grew up in Ireland. I saw the stuff in the north of Ireland. And violence is awful. War is outrageous. To send these young people halfway around the world into a war that was unnecessary is just so beyond the pale. There was no thought put into it. And this president can actually sleep at night. It's amazing, you know, that
he seems all right with it.
Huh?
He seems okay with it.
Yeah,
I'm agreeing with you.
He's religious too, you know. Religion can do that to you, and he, you know, I would say he felt he was right in doing what he was doing. I'm sure he felt he was right, and he can sleep at night. But war is not that way. He wouldn't go to war when he had his opportunity in Vietnam. He got his gig down in an Air Force base, which he didn't show up for, you know. And I'm not using it as a personal thing against him, but the whole idea that violence, sort of war, is a series of surgical strikes. You see someone with their face burned off. You know, we get these people coming to see the band, and we encourage them to come. They're called wounded warriors, right? And usually they come in wheelchairs, and we're all used to that from TV and from movies and whatever. You know, the whole idea that the wounded warrior comes back in a wheelchair. And then one day, one night, this guy arrives in, and the doorman, the security guy, comes rushing over, and he said, you know, one of the wounded warriors is here, and we got to let him in. I said, of course we got to let him in. He said, yeah, but sure, yeah, we're going to let him in. And then I was thinking, well, what's the big deal? Guy's walking. He walked over to me, and half his face was gone. It was the most stunning thing, because I had to actually stare into his face, and it wasn't there, you know. It was totally reconstructed, but it just wasn't there. And he was down with it, no problem, very self-confident guy. In the course of the night, he was chatting up girls and everything, but he had no face. And it was then that it hit me really then, this is war. You can get your face blown off, you know. And I was like, wow. And it took the longest time. It took a couple of drinks before I could actually finally relax and look at this guy without feeling weird. Huh?
Well, sure. I mean, that's
how
not
war
something you
is.
See every day, and it's not something you want to see every day.
But people think of war as this thing on in the movies. They don't even think of it as Rambo. They think of it as some more civilized Rambo. But war is an awful thing. Basically people killing each other.
I think a movie like, I think more recent movies have given a lot better feel for the reality of it. And of course, it's still just a movie. But something like Saving Private Ryan, man, you know, I didn't come out of that thinking
no.
War is clean and surgical, you know.
That first scene was shot in my hometown on the beach, 5 miles from my hometown. The
really?
Invasion, yeah. They wanted to find a place that looked like Normandy beaches, and my local beach was the one that they used.
That's a gut-wrenching scene.
Yeah, it showed what war is, that war is, and that was nothing as compared to what it is, and that's the feeling I'm getting back from the guys who, and the women who write back. It's like, I got an email from a guy today, and he said, yeah, I'm okay, man. There's no problem with me. I do jump every time any kind of an explosion goes off around me. You know, I mean, a car bangs or something. Anytime there's a loud noise, I'm in the air still, but I'm not messed up like all the guys you read about. I'm just airborne whenever there's a loud sound.
Well, we have a really good friend who's also one of our editors, Diana Hartman, and her husband just retired from the military, and he has been to Iraq, and they lived over in Germany for the last several years. They just moved back to the U.S., and her central theme is, until you see these people, just what you're saying, the way she puts it is, the people who are killed, I mean, they're the lucky ones. And obviously their families aren't, their loved ones aren't, people who care about them, they're not lucky. But the people who are actually killed are, in a sense, the lucky ones. 'Cause
right.
She said, they focus so much on, okay, you know, so what's the what's the death count now? You know, it's at X amount after...
Just under 4,000.
After, you know, X amount of years. But it's tens of thousands that have been injured, and
yeah,
many of those permanently and, you know, viciously. And, you know, and there's all kinds of, you know, emotional and mental issues to go along with the physical issues. And I think that's finally starting to come out now because we've been at war long enough that kind of all the obvious themes have worn out. Enough people are coming back or have come back, and you're starting to hear a little bit more about it. But, you know, that's really one of her central themes. She's just outraged by the, you know, the lack of attention to the psychological needs of and the way people are treated.
Well, was it ever going to be any different? I mean, she's outraged, that's one thing, but did she think it was going to be any different than that?
Well, I'm not sure, but she...
I'm not running her down.
She's certainly working on it.
But this wasn't a war that was planned in any sense. There was nothing planned for the disaster it's become. So it was obvious to me it was going to be a disaster because, you know, you go in, you invade someone else's country, they don't care, you know. What are these people doing here? And on top of everything else, they're crusaders, they're Christians in a solidly, you know, Muslim world. And if you spend any time in a Muslim country, you realize that, you know, this is their world. They don't want Christians in there telling them how to act, telling them how to do. This is an echo of the crusade wars. Yeah.
Well, that's true. The other thing is that you bring up is there's such a huge gap and discrepancy between theory, you know, what may make sense in theory on paper at a safe remove, right, is a whole different thing in practice, in reality. And
yeah,
it's very difficult to balance those. And you know, it's hard to be a leader. I mean, because there are times when war, I think, is necessary or is the best course of action. So you do have to be. You can't be paralyzed, you know, with fear about it, and you can't be paralyzed by the casualties. But on the other hand, you certainly have to take that into account, and you have to really be judicious and weigh that. And it's very difficult. It's very difficult to be a leader and with that kind of responsibility, literally life and death over people. Hey, let's talk a little bit about the band. We haven't really mentioned anyone. And also, since apparently the chat room is still not working, which is always a really nice way to communicate and for people to talk to each other and ask us questions and whatnot, we want to be sure to make sure to welcome people to call in. We'd really be happy to have any questions, any comments, and that's at 646-595-3195. That's 646-595-3195. And we welcome your questions, comments, fans, whomever. We'd be happy to talk to you. Why don't we talk about the band a little bit? Could you go run through the band members and instrumentation? It's kind of an interesting lineup of with the trombone and the saxophone kind of integrated with a pretty traditional rock and roll band, almost a clashy kind of feel, but then you got the horns.
Well, the band started as a duo, myself. I was playing electric guitar, and we had a drum machine at the time, and an Illan pipe player. They're kind of like bagpipes, except you don't blow into them. They're much more complicated. You use your elbow to fill a bag or a sack, which pumps the air into them, and they have two octaves rather than the one that the bagpipes have. So there were the two of us at first, but I had come from an improv scene. And the trombone player, Freddie Parcells, he thought it was an improv band, so he just came in and sat in one night, and I was thinking, wow, we didn't even invite you, Fred, but here you are.
That was kind of forward of him.
Yeah, and so he started to play the same lines as the Illan pipes, so it was trombone, Illan pipes, and guitar, electric guitar. And it sounded to me like, wow, that's the most unusual sound I've ever heard. It was kind of like a Celtic New Orleans marching band, funeral band almost sometimes, because we were, you know, doing Irish ballads sometimes. And then the sax player, Jeffrey Blythe, was with a band called Dexys Midnight Runners in England, and he was over here. I knew his wife, and she said, "Jeff's gone up the walls, sitting at home." I said, "Set him down, and bring the sax down." So he came down, he sat in, and then sometimes Freddie, the trombone player, couldn't play, but we were playing in Irish bars at the time. They needed four people. That was kind of the rule. So I would take along on percussion Thomas Hamlin, who was into African drumming. And then eventually we added a bass player. And so it's that mixture. But so it started very organically with basically the horns and the Ilan pipes being the lead instruments rather than the guitar. I mean, I play some lead guitar too, but the intent was to have it be less established rock, you know, which the guitar is usually the main lead instrument. So that was the genesis of the band.
Interesting. It's a very interesting sound, and it does sound very organic. It's very well integrated. And yeah, we want to remind people that you guys are out playing live really, really quite often.
Yeah,
and
we play about 100 dates a year. This Friday will be in Hartford, in Connecticut, at the Half Door on Sisson Avenue. And on Saturday we'll be in Harvard Square in Cambridge, in Massachusetts, at a place called Tommy Doyle's, which was the old House of Blues there. And then we go out to the West Coast the following week.
Yes.
Santa Cruz, San Francisco, and up in Sonora, up in the mountains, at an Irish festival.
And then you're coming my way. You're coming to Ohio.
Yeah,
Columbus and Cleveland. Yeah, I'm just outside Cleveland.
Oh, yeah, we're in Cleveland also. We're in the
Beachland Ballroom.
Yeah.
On the 14th. Gosh, I hope I can make it. That would really be great. I wish my schedule wasn't so ridiculous. I have, besides running the site and being kind of tied to that and doing now we're doing a lot of radio, internet radio, which is really fun. It's great to be back on the radio again. I got four kids, and it's hard to get out. What day of the week is the 14th, though? That would be great, because I've never seen you guys live.
Oh, you should come. It's a party. I mean, it's political, but it's not.
It's a political party.
You know, we do a lot of songs that are not political, too. You know, it's not. I was never of the idea that there should be a singer up there preaching. I actually hate preaching. The Black 47 songs are all allegorical. They're all story songs. So you may get a message or you may not. You may be just into the characters in the story and the rhythm and the horn lines and whatever.
That's art.
Now, of course, for St. Paddy's Day, it looks like you're going to be B.B. King Blues Club in New York.
Yeah, we played that the last 3 years, I think.
I bet that's a popular date.
Oh, it starts early, too.
Oh, I bet.
So people come right from the parade. The doors open at 5, and we go on at 7.
I used to DJ for a living, and, man, every St. Patrick's Day, you know, we'd go to any of the bars, any of the chains, you know, especially those with Irish themes, quote-unquote. I mean, we'd start at 10 in the morning.
Yeah, and go right through, yeah.
It was an ordeal.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the 14th is a Friday. So, you know, we really should be able to make that.
Good.
So that would be terrific.
That's a great club, and it's the east side of Ohio, or Cleveland, right?
Yep, it is. It's the east side, pretty close to the lake. Somewhat gentrifying neighborhood. In fact, the club, the Beachland Ballroom, has really kind of been the center, the focal point of a real change in that neighborhood.
Yeah, it was an old Croatian club, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, you're right.
If I remember.
Very good memory.
Yeah, well, I've been there. I know Cleveland pretty well. I know the flats, and you know.
Yes,
I used to know the flats.
They're retooling the flats.
Yeah, the flats just are great. Peabody's is down there, right?
Yep, sure is.
Club.
Yeah, my son has played Peabody's, which that shows you how old I am. Yeah, he was in a he was, it makes me even feel older, he's not in the band anymore. He's graduated. He was in a death metal band, really successful, actually. They were offered a contract a few times, but they played all the big clubs and opened for all the, you know, touring national, international death metal bands coming through the area. But, yeah, when he was about, 16 to 19 maybe, before he went away to college, he was really seriously in a band. They played Peabody's, a few times a month.
Yeah, that's a good, it was a good club.
Very interesting. Well, I know you're something of a Renaissance man. You're not just a musician, I think you mentioned it briefly, but you're a novelist, right, and a playwright. Why don't we talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah, I wrote a book. I was started in plays in the theater. I wrote a play that became kind of successful called Liverpool Fantasy, If the Beatles Hadn't Made It. And it broke up in 1962, and Paul goes off to Vegas and becomes Paul Montana, becomes a big singer and a big cabaret singer, and then comes back to reform the Beatles, put them on American TV, but there's been no 60s or anything, so it's a whole different political system. And so it's about that. And then I turned that into a novel later, which is available. You get it at any Barnes & Noble or wherever. It's called Liverpool Fantasy. So, you know, I swing between the three worlds, music, theater, and novels.
Are you working on anything now?
Yeah, I just got one done recently. It's an immigrant one. It's about the Bronx in the 1980s. The Bronx is a big Irish immigrant area, so it's kind of an interesting way to look at New York City from the immigrant eyes, you know, people who weren't integrated into society, but who can still have a view of it, you know. So, that's called Rockin' the Bronx.
Is that out now?
No, it'll probably be another 6 months before it's out. It's a long incubation period between writing a book and actually getting it on the shelves.
Oh, yeah, I know. Do you have a publisher, though?
Well, actually, my publisher, that's one of the problems. My publisher just got bought by another publisher, so I'm not totally sure. But I got a new agent, so we'll see. Yeah.
Well, as an author myself, I know how all that works.
Yeah. So
very complicated, and it can be very frustrating.
Yeah, totally.
And there's not all that much money in it.
No. You've got to have a big hit kind of to do it, you know.
But it's very satisfying.
Yeah, it is when the book is finally done and, you know, people... Well, that's the difference between books and plays, I think, that makes books a little easier is because with the play you have that great moment, a real organic moment where it's up on stage and you're seeing it, but there's so few people who actually really see it because once the play is over, that's essentially the end of it. You don't usually, because of actors' equity, you're not allowed to tape plays usually. And so that's the end of it. Whereas with a book, when you do it, it's still on the shelves and people are passing it around amongst each other, you know, if they're interested in it.
That's a good point. That's an interesting point. It's a very different kind of ontology, you know, the reality of it. A book is a physical thing. It's there. It's going to last. The words
portable.
Are there. And the play, I mean, you need a number of people to collaborate.
Yeah, it's a big job to put on a play. Plays are getting harder and harder to do because just the sheer money aspect of it. I mean, I go into it because I love it so much, but it can be really trying, you know.
Have you acted as well?
No, I never acted, no. I never really wanted to. I mean, I do it sometimes, you know, just to...
If you're a lead singer in a rock band, you're part actor.
Yeah, well, you are, you know, but the thing is you can change it any time you like, whereas with the play, you, to a certain degree, you're stuck with the character, and you have the other characters and the other actors who don't want you to really change your part. Whereas to me, doing, say, you know, a normal four-week run of that, six nights a week, that would drive me around the bend.
Oh, I agree entirely. You know, when you think
and
about...
actors tend to be all crazy, and I'm crazy enough.
I understand. I mean, it really is remarkable when, you know, you hear so-and-so, this actor, that actor signs up for a, you know, 2-3 year run, you know, on a Broadway show.
Yeah, that's the end of them.
Imagine
kind of,
that.
It
the same
totally
thing.
Burns them. Yeah.
God, it's amazing. I mean, you can see why people want to, no matter how much they love the stage, want to vary it with film and or TV, because it's so much easier.
Definitely.
At least physically, I would think. What, from an artistic standpoint, what do you get out of the different media? How are they different for you? What are you receiving from writing a book versus writing a play versus being a rock star?
Well, the music is the most immediate because you're up on stage. The minute you hit that chord, you're there in the moment with it. So that's very immediate. And the songwriting tends to be more immediate in that sense, too, in that you're writing a shard of an experience. You don't really need to do a full story of it. As you could tell, say, with the song from Iraq, Stars and Stripes, about two guys who are pinned down in Anbar province waiting for a helicopter to come and rescue them. So it's all about that hour that they're there, that moment, you know.
It's very powerful, by the way.
Yeah, it's just like it's there, you know, and you're in the middle of it, and whatever the song length is, 4.5 minutes or something, you're just totally there for it when you're performing it. With the play, essentially when you write a play, you're writing the bones of it, really. Playwriting, unlike what most people think of, is how do you get rid of things rather than how do you put long speeches in. It's how do you get it, distill it down. And then you hand it over to a director and actors, and in a certain way, you're out of the picture at that point. And now it will never turn out to be the way you originally saw it. Sometimes it can actually turn out to be better, and sometimes it can turn out to be really awful. And you're still blamed for it, even, you know, if it is, or you're praised for it if it's turning out in a way that's different than the way you saw it and turning out better. So there's a certain unreality to it, but it's very collaborative playwriting. You have to be able to give up at some point and give it over to someone else to take it over, right?
Right. That makes sense.
And then with the novel, it's basically you, and it used to be you and a pencil and a pad. Now it's you and your mouse and a computer screen, as you know yourself. So it's really you against the page.
Right.
It's whatever comes out of you.
It's very solitary.
It's solitary, but the good thing about it is you can do it at any time. You don't need people around you.
Right, right.
So there's that. And, of course, then the opposite side of that is it's just you.
The challenge is, for me anyway, with writing a book in particular, it's actually why I was really responded well to blogging. You know, when I first started, I really found it to be a breath of fresh air in that it was so quick and relatively informal. But with the book, you really have to find a routine, and you can't think too far ahead. I can see where it's really daunting for people who just keep thinking about that finished product. How can I possibly write that many words? How can I possibly write that many chapters? How can I be so disciplined? But once you're into it, if you just do it day to day.
Yeah,
just
a leap of faith.
Yeah.
Incremental.
Exactly. If you approach it day to day, you know, here's what I'm working on today, and just do it piece by piece, and try to enjoy the process, then it really can be fun. And and all of a sudden, hey, you know, you've accumulated a whole book. But those are kind of mental games that you're playing with yourself, you know, psyching yourself up and all that. But I certainly know what you mean, and I still haven't yet. I've written short stories, but I haven't written anything longer form that's fictional. I've kind of done things where most of the 80s and into the 90s, kind of my core job anyway was as I mentioned earlier, was a DJ, and I owned the DJ company, and it was just very involved. So I have a lot of stories from that time, And I've kind of written up a fair number of them and fictionalized them to a certain extent because, you know, you got to protect the guilty and the innocent.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had kids from 1984 on, so there's probably some things that are better left fictionalized. But, yeah, at some point, I'd like to be able to kind of string those, you know, what amount to kind of standalone stories together into a larger piece.
Speaking of kids, I actually didn't know I was on for an hour, but my kid is doing his homework, and I'm going to have to go in the next couple of minutes.
No problem. Yeah, I mean, you've ended up doing 50 minutes. We really appreciate it. Been really, really interesting talking to you. You're a fascinating guy, very thoughtful, and I really wish you the very best on the new album. Because, there's politics involved in it, but I think it's much more than that. It really is a empathetic work of art, and it really is easy to place yourself as a listener, I should say, to place yourself in these scenes that you create, and I think you really have done an exceptional job with that.
Well, that's great. Well, it's it'll be out on March 4th, and you know, it'll be in the stores, but people can get it on all the online places, and they can get it on. They can actually even get it on our site right now, black47.com. It'll go out tonight if anybody wants to call in and get it. We have some advanced copies ready to go.
Excellent. Yeah, it's a great site, too. Black47, the number 47.com. You got the tour information. You got some music clips. There's pictures. There's video. The shop, forum, blog. And your blog's interesting, too. I know you're really, really busy. It's too bad you can't get to it more often because it's really good stuff.
It's kind of tricky. Well, thanks so much, man.
All right, Larry. Thank you very much.
And good luck to the show.
Thanks.
Well, that was very nice to talk to Larry. Thank you again. Everybody, please check out the band's website at black47.com. You can also check out the website of their new label, United for Opportunity. That's ufomusic.com. There, at either one of those sites, you'll find out more about the new album, Iraq. It is due out this Tuesday, March 4th. And there is tour information. You can find out if they're playing near you. And dig around the black47.com a little bit. There's actually quite a few interesting things on there.
Yeah. It was Lisa, are you there?
I am.
Yay! It was interesting that he knew the One people and, you know, had seen the Academy Awards. That was I assume you watched the show since we have a few minutes.
The whole thing. I managed to stay awake right until the bitter end.
I thought it was great. I really enjoyed it.
I thought it was breezy. I wasn't particularly surprised, I guess, by any of the main things. I was so delighted that song won Best Song from One. So you know, I thought compared to the stuff from Enchanted, which I really didn't like it all.
Well,
the movie or just the song?
The song.
It was so contrived.
Yeah, I haven't seen the movie, and I have nothing against Disney animated musicals. There's been a whole bunch of them I've really enjoyed. I just thought these were kind of unremarkable.
It's just very contrived, and I think the difference was seeing something that's kind of arch, and I'm sure they fit well in the film. My kids have seen it. I haven't seen it yet. It's not on DVD. I'm sure I will when it's out on DVD. And
over and over and over again.
Over and over and over again. And of course, now we got to switch over to Blu-ray now. The word has come down from heaven that Blu-ray is the way to go forward. So. Because so far I haven't seen any Disney's on in the HD format because they're all on Blu-ray, and I picked the wrong horse when we got our HD DVD player back in December. But I don't really regret it because I love that player, and we've watched what we've watched, and the player plays any other DVDs other than Blu-ray anyway, so it's not like, you know, it suddenly becomes obsolete.
And it upsamples them to your
HD upsamples
TV
them
resolution.
Very well, exactly, very, very well. So, it's really a, exceptional player anyway. And
so that's what you're telling yourself to help.
That's what I'm telling myself. I mean, compared to the prices now, I paid too much. There's no question. I had a great deal at the time, but it just shows you how quickly things can change. Anyway,
now I think they're giving them away, aren't they?
They pretty much are. I just saw Microsoft, the one that they.
The Xbox 360 player?
Right, $50. Did you see that? Oh, my, that's something. But
I'm very pleased that for once I convinced Jim not to be an early adopter. we're always like the first kids on the block, and you know what happens. You know, you pay $500 for something that next year you can get for half the price with twice the features.
You know where I am. I'm not as cutting edge as he is. And of course, you know, I mean, that's what he does, and he's for a living too. And he, you know, he's a tech guy. We know that. But I'm not that far. But I do find myself more recently because in the last, my background. You guys know I was a DJ all those years, and I had really good equipment. It wasn't, it's kind of standard stuff for DJs, but still, I mean, it was loud, very powerful, well maintained because that's what I did. That was my job. I had to have real good equipment. I had to maintain it well. Had to be durable. Had to sound good. So, you know, I had a lot of stuff. And then when I stopped that, you know, kind of in the process of getting divorced and moving back here and all that, I shed most of my equipment. And then I was kind of hunkered down, starting my new life and being a writer again and getting back into TV and radio and all that, none of which pays squat, let's face it. But, fun, interesting, self-fulfillment, self-development, all that good stuff. But I didn't have a bunch of money is what it comes down to. And not that I have a bunch now, but, you know, I have a little more now than I've had for the last 15 years anyway. So, I find myself my midlife, averting a midlife crisis by being really kind of interested in audio-visual technology again. And it's fun. But Dawn said the other day, man, you're getting obsessive about this. And she's right, because you feel yourself being pulled into it, and at first, oh, yeah, that's good enough. But then as you learn more and you research more, then, man, you want to get right up to that cutting edge. Yeah, I want to hear that. I want to participate in that. I want to see that. But like you say, Lisa, I mean, it's just too expensive to be that first wave. You got to at least wait, one wave, come along in the second wave, because then it's the bugs are out. It's a lot cheaper. Usually that first wave, it doesn't work all that well anyway.
Yeah, this is true.
So anyway, back to, we digress, but back to Enchanted. I'm sure, I've heard it's really good, and the kids loved it. Lily really has pretty good taste, pretty sophisticated taste. She and my dad go to the movies, almost weekly, especially in the summer and during vacations. I mean, they go all the time. It pretty much, when any acceptable movie comes out, they go see it for kids. And so she has, pretty sophisticated taste for an 8-year-old, and we got a bunch of DVDs, and we have cable and all that, too. So she's seen an awful lot of stuff, and she really liked it. But I'm sure those songs fit fine, within the context of the movie. I sure don't think they needed to nominate all three. They could have represented, two other films, I think, rather than three from one movie. But it feels very jokey. They felt kind of jokey and artificial, And the difference was, the one song, it was just beautiful and the interplay of their voices. And, couldn't have been more real.
Yeah.
And there couldn't have been more of a contrast between the artificial, artifice, showbiz, Hollywood, Disney, all these archetypes. And then Irish street musicians on the other end of the dial. And it was real nice to see them win. So what else stood out in your mind about the show?
I really like Jon Stewart a lot as a host. I've been missing Billy Crystal all these years since he stopped doing it. I don't think anybody's really been great at it. I really thought Billy Crystal was kind of like the pinnacle of Oscar hosting. And, you know, if the host is boring, the whole show just, like, totally drags. Because listening to people, you know, saying who's coming on, who's nominated, isn't really a huge, big thrill. And I think Stewart's kind of making it into his own gig now, and I kind of like that.
I like him, too. A nice blend of being convivial and friendly with some edge, too.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of a hard line to walk because you have to be sort of deferential to the stars, but not too deferential.
Exactly. It is hard, and most hosts come down too far one side or the other.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that music is our warning. We've got a very few seconds to go. So I'll just close out by saying this has been BC Radio Live. We broadcast live every Wednesday night at 9 p.m. Eastern, so please visit us at blogtalkradio.com/BC Radio, and we will talk to you next week.